Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 6, 1999. In the fireside room this afternoon is Mary Carlson with Dan Spencer. Today's session number is 99-9, and it's titled Bioethics and Faith, to Tell or Not to Tell, a session on genetic testing. Let's listen in.
Dan Spencer, and I teach ethics and religion at Drake University in Des Moines, and my partner this week is...
Oh, I'm Mary Carlson, and I teach social work at St. Olaf College, Northfield, Minnesota.
And this is the fourth of a five-part series on bioethics and faith. Our session today is on genetic testing, called To Test or Not to Test, To Tell or Not to Tell. And Mary's going to give us some more background about the whole realm of genetic testing and what kind of issues and questions that brings up. But can you give me a sense about, are there folks who are new here for the first time? Got a smattering of folks here. Good. Okay. And it's always helpful to know in terms of how much background review to do at the beginning of the session. How about anybody here who's had direct experience with genetics? Either you're a geneticist or you've had issues in your family or got at least
good classes.
A few folks took some classes in it, right? Good. All right. Well, the case we're going to be focusing on today is a genetic disorder called neurofibromatosis. And I know we've got at least one member who's had a lot of experience with that. Any other folks here who've had experience with that particular disorder? One of the things that's been really fun this week is with each of the cases that we've done, there have been people in the group who've had some direct experience in it, either in medical practice or family situations, so forth. And so we're really building on those experiences as we do the cases together. I'm going to do just a very brief review. Part of what our goal has been for the week is that, starting from the awareness that the complexity around bioethical issues is only going to increase during our lifetimes, it behooves us to get some experience with thinking how to think through these issues. And particularly if you don't have a lot of training or expertise in medicine, in the sciences, how does the average layperson begin to think through some of these issues? So both Mary and I work with undergraduates in this area. And what we've been doing is helping people get some familiarity with some vocabulary in ethics. So we've been going over these common terms in ethics. We've particularly been distinguishing between an ethical issue, which is any course of action that affects human well-being in ethics. So anytime we relate to others, there's an ethical component in that. But distinguishing that from an ethical dilemma, which is what we've been focusing on primarily this week. An ethical dilemma being when any time when our ethical values, principles, or our actions in a situation come into conflict. And so, for example, when we looked at physician-assisted suicide, you have the autonomy of the patient who desires a particular end. You have the physician's duty to do no harm to the patient. There's a conflict there in terms of that desire. Or we looked at issues around confidentiality. If someone confides in you something, but the information they confide poses a threat to someone else, do you have a duty to break confidentiality or keep confidentiality? So when we have conflicts in our ethical responsibilities or duties, then we're in the realm of dilemmas. We have to make some choices. And what we've been trying to emphasize is that this should not be simply a random or simply a gut reaction to how to think about that. But there are ways to think through these steps and to do it thoughtfully and with some degree of comprehensiveness. So we have been using a six-step process here that I think at least covers several different bases. It helps us to think about what are the ethical dimensions of an issue? Is there a conflict? If so, where? What are some of the different alternatives that we can think about? How do we think about the potential consequences of those alternatives? And then how do we assess them? So this week we've been doing step one together. We've been presenting a case and then get talking about the relevant facts and information so that we all start on board together from that. Then we've been asking you as a group to begin to identify the ethical issues here. I'll come back and talk a little bit about some of the basic principles, but what are the ethical dimensions that are involved in any particular case? And is there in fact a dilemma? We mentioned that both Mary and I have worked on bioethics committees, and at least in my case, the vast majority of the ethics consults that we get called into don't involve an ethical dilemma. They usually are problems of communication between, say, the doctor and the family, or between the nurses and the chaplain, or whatever. There's oftentimes communication issues, something else that can be resolved short of a dilemma. But on occasion, there are true dilemmas where we've got these ethical conflicts. And then we've been asking you to generate some different alternatives and begin to assess them in light of the ethical dimensions that are involved there. final step, and this will be an interesting one in the case today, is motive relevant? There are going to be some different characters in our case today that have different motives. How do you evaluate whether those are ethical or unethical? How do they affect it? And then finally, how do you choose an alternative and justify it? Justify it oftentimes by saying why it's a better alternative than some other ones. Now, Mary has mentioned several times as we've gone through the week, there are lots of different ways to do ethics, and we're presenting one model. It's not the only model. Ours is called a mixed or a contextual model because it draws on at least a couple different features. One is it does draw on a principles approach. It says there are some basic principles or action guides, guidelines, about what is moral in most situations that can guide our behavior. But it also pays attention to consequences, or sometimes called a consequentialist approach to ethics. How do we look at what are our likely consequences, and are those good or bad consequences? The basic grounding for ethics has been respect for persons. We believe that human beings or persons have intrinsic value, value for their own sake, and therefore that's a starting point there. But there are already are debates about what that means. Does that mean we always respect the sanctity of life, that life itself is sacred, and therefore you always act in ways to preserve or enhance life? Or are there some situations where quality of life can override the sanctity of life? End-of-life situations where in order to respect the person, you make decisions based on their quality of life and what they would like. Coming out of that, there are four main issues that have informed much of the bioethics discussion. Non-maleficence is the basis of the Western ethical tradition. The Hippocratic Oath starts on the premise of whatever else, do not harm. Do not intentionally harm your patients there. And the converse of that, or related to it, is beneficence. That is the physician or the healthcare provider's duty to promote the well-being of their patient. Now, we have emphasized the whole well-being. Sometimes this has been seen primarily as the physical or the medical well-being, but increasingly people are saying our emotional needs, our mental needs, our spiritual needs are part of our well-being, and we need to have that be part of what it means to heal, promote good, promote well-being. The other foundational principle in the Western tradition is autonomy, that individuals have the right to self-determination, have the right to choose what is of courses of actions that most deeply affect them. And we've talked about how that's really embedded in our society, in a very core value in our society with the Bill of Rights, our freedoms, our individual rights and freedoms. But that also much informs medical discussion here. And so you could, many of the conflicts will determine between the physician's duty to non-maleficence, beneficence, and the patient's right to autonomy, those may not always agree in terms of a course of action. The other thing is when we start to look at this more broadly, move beyond simply an individual case, we're into the realm of justice. How do we make decisions that are based that are fair, that have some degree of equity, both between how different individuals are treated in similar situations, but also the use of resources. Many bioethical issues would not be there if we didn't have scarce resources. But the fact is we do have limited resources, and scarce resources. We have to make a choice about how best to use them. And that can oftentimes bring conflicts. Out of that, then, are several other related issues which will be involved in our case today. Confidentiality flows from autonomy, that individuals have the right to privacy, to control private information, and who gets that divulged. There's also a premise that your healthcare provider will relate to you based on honesty and vitality, will not intentionally deceive you, not intentionally betray your trust. Utility is an approach that many people argue is an important one. Somebody says you should act in a way that maximizes good, the greatest good for the greatest number. That can be use of resources, that can be the number of people who are affected by a particular course of action. How do we think about utility? The burden benefit I think we won't get into today, we can come back to it. So that I'm gonna turn it over to Mary to give us some background on information. But let me just check, any questions or things that are not clear about this very brief overview to get us on board here? Yeah.
I didn't hear you use the word morality.
Yeah.
Anytime, any place in all of this.
We did that first couple days, and I have to admit I've been going fairly quickly over it here. Morality is the first term we have on our common terms here, and it simply is that area that deals with choices and behaviors which we determine to be right or wrong. That can be out of a religious basis, it can be out of a cultural basis, it can be out of a philosophical basis, and that's oftentimes where people disagree. Christians may disagree with Native Americans about a particular course of what's right or wrong. But this Morality, then choice is the right or wrong behavior, and then ethics is when we systematize that, look at that in a kind of a more formal way. But it's an important point because morality will be the underlying basis for all our discussions here.
And then let me just add to that, bioethics, which is our focus, is a subfield of ethics, which looks at ethical considerations in a healthcare medical setting.
So based on 1 through 9 anyway, would you conclude that the actions of the Donner Party were ethical?
Actions of the
Donner Party.
Well, if you're a utilitarian and you're maximizing good, you have a choice. If everybody dies or some people die. Some people would say you could argue that. Other people would say no, sanctity of life is always the dominant principle. You could never maximize your own good by depriving someone else. I mean, this is where the debate would be. People would argue in different ways of combining these about that particular situation.
And here's my deep wish, is that people will keep arguing and debating and being engaged and not have what happens to some of my students at age 21. So it's either too complicated, I can't cope with it, or it sounds to me like you could argue any position and so anybody's right, and what I think and you think, if we differ, we'll just let it go. And as we talk at St. Olaf about sliding into relativism, I hope that's not the case. And part of our goal is to get people familiar enough so that you don't just give up when you disagree with somebody, but you get at your deepest grounding of belief and what helps you to make a choice in a very difficult situation. I will say, for those of you who've been with us all week, you're lucky that there are new people every time, because our debate, we thought we might just flip these up and test you all and see what you would come up with. On the affirming side, as I walk around the village and either listen in, which I do all too often, to conversation, or am a part of them, which I love to be, people are using these words. How many of you have used some of these concepts this week just in talking to folks? That's our goal. Our goal is that you use them and you try to use them as carefully as you can so people at least can engage each other and communicate. Okay, as we pick cases to introduce here, it's both a joy and sort of an anxiety producer to pick cases where we're not experts in the content. Dan and I do not do organ transplantation, organ procurement. Neither of us is a donor or recipient at this point in our life. So we're grateful when people are in the room who know that specific content about a case. We use cases to bring up the ethical issues that can be used in a number of different related kinds of cases. That's true for today and tomorrow. We're doing cases in human genetics. We are not geneticists, either one of us. Fortunately, we have one in the village. He's not here because it's too close to work, and I so respect that. I said, stay away, it's too close to work. But he looked over our cases and was really very helpful to what we want to present today. So I'd like to say that to both engage you all and thank you for being here when you know some of the stuff that we're presenting. Let me give you a little bit of background about human genetics and genetic testing that will be useful, and then we'll dig into the case, and more stuff may well come out in our debriefing of the case. Many of you have heard of the Human Genome Project? If you read papers, it gets a lot of press. We have scientists in three different places in our country who are working very hard to map all 100,000 human genes. As we talked to Bob last evening, he said they're about halfway through. Trouble is they've done the easy half, sort of randomly finding the genes they've done thus far. So the harder work is ahead, but it's moving very rapidly. And in the next 3 to 5 years, we assume, all 100,000 human genes will be mapped genetically, which is, to me, a phenomenal concept to have that mapped.
Besides, which institution or which organization is doing the mapping?
Yeah, NIH, for the federal government, mapping, National Institutes of Health, the U.S. government in D.C., Bethesda, Maryland. Livermore Laboratory, California is doing a piece of it.
And for some, it's private.
And
there's
then a private.
A whole consortium of private.
Yeah.
It's not currently federally regulated.
Genentech is probably the one. That's a familiar name. Okay. One of the reasons we think it's important to talk about sort of burgeoning and emerging issues is that all throughout ethics, part of our feeling in the field is that we're just working hard to catch up to science, to technology, to medicine, which is forging ahead at rapid rates that are mind-boggling. And moral, ethical, religious consideration has not kept up and kept pace. Somebody pointed out last night, what are the seminaries doing about this kind of conversation? Some said, well, some are doing some. But I think all of us as lay people and people of faith need to be understanding more and pushing these issues in ways that we think are important to talk about. In genetic testing, there are two kinds of tests in general. One is a test that is predictive, that says, if you have this gene, you will have this disease. That's a predictive test. The other is a test that says, well, you're at some risk for this test. It's important to know in any case what kind of test we're talking about. Is this predictive, or is this possible, or highly likely, or somewhere in there? That will always raise questions. Genetic testing is also done by people. It's done by people, which means it's not 100% accurate. They use little machines, they use strips, they use microscopes, they are tired sometimes, they've been up 12 hours, whatever it might be. So accuracy of a test is also commonly an issue in some of these cases. Genetic tests can be very expensive. The test that we're talking about today for NF1, neurofibromatosis 1, costs about $2,000. Is not available everywhere. Only certain labs can do this test. The test for the breast cancer gene, BRCA1, somewhere, what did he say?
$2,400.
So cost of one test can also be an issue, as can availability. In some parts of our country, I'm sure, people can't get the test, or in many parts of our country, people don't have the coverage or the money themselves to pay for the test if their insurance won't or they don't have insurance. The genetics community has worked up some guidelines for doing testing. Did I decide we were going to share that first off?
I think I'll wait for that.
Okay. And then for many people, there's the concern of eugenics. When we talk tomorrow about human cloning, that will come up even more. But are we truly in this human genome project in a rush to know what we might have if we live long enough or marry certain people? Or choose to have biological children, what effects might that have? Are we moving on some sort of slope towards perfecting humanity? Because we talk often about aborting certain kinds of fetuses with certain issues and those kinds of things. So that is a large question. It's important for today's case to know that there really aren't any federal laws governing genetic testing of children. That is people under age 18, 17 and under. No federal law that says, yes, you should always do it in this case, never do it in this case. For these diseases, you should. For these diseases, you shouldn't. There isn't unanimity on that issue at the moment. So it's really emerging and a burgeoning issue.
Are there laws for adults?
No. No.
No. Children, adults?
Not as far as I know. Yeah. We're probably getting close on the breast cancer gene. That's where a lot of the ferment is right at the moment, because breast cancer kills 1 out of 9 women. Now the question is, it is 1 out of 9 women have it. Sorry, excuse me, 1 out of 9 women have it. But only a small percentage of those women who have it have the genetic breast cancer. So, but it certainly raises issues for many of us.
Clarification.
Yeah.
You said there are no laws regarding testing of people under 17. What do you mean by testing, like?
Well, I mean laws that say for this particular test, all kids should be tested for this particular disease or genetic disorder.
Yeah, but there are after birth, like a heel stick, kind of, that the kids have to get. That's by law.
PKU testing is required.
Yeah.
And a list of 7 or 8 tests that are many states routine.
Okay, name those so we know. That would be useful. The PKU.
Hypothyroidism. For our state, hypothyroidism, PKU. Congenital adrenal maple syrup hearing disease, homocystinuria.
I hope the tape picks up.
They test for the state of Alaska, their program goes under Oregon, and they test for about 7 or 8 diseases that you don't see in the child. Because if you don't work on them early, you can have a disastrous result.
And those are all diseases that the child would have at birth if he or she had it.
And are treatable.
And are treatable. Okay, that gets into the guidelines, which will, thank you for that.
Well, that does raise a couple of the issues to be thinking about as Mary's about to give us the case here, is the difference between predictive, it's the certainty that it'll have it versus a probability risk in there, and then the burden versus benefit of knowing something. I mean, if it's treatable versus untreatable, so if it's predictive and treatable, chances are there's a very good benefit of knowing that information. If it's predictive and untreatable, at what point do you want a child to know or an adult to know? If it's probability and treatable, and probability versus untreatable. So these combinations raise some very interesting issues about whether the burden of knowing or the benefit of knowing outweighs each other.
We're going to look at the case, and then as you read it and ask questions, we'll have more to discuss about this particular disease itself. Are you going to read that, or am I going to read it?
You're going to read it.
Okay. Let me read it for the tape while it's going around. Title of this case is To Test or Not to Test, To Tell or Not to Tell. You have two children, ages 9 and 7. In 1990, scientists isolated the gene which, when defective, can cause the neurological genetic disorder neurofibromatosis 1. This disease is inherited by 50% of children who have a parent with the gene. Because your brother was diagnosed with this disease, you decide to get tested and are told you have the gene. Though manifestations of the disease are usually mild, some patients can experience disfiguring facial and/or bodily tumors, which can include severe brain tumors. These tumors may also press on vital organs, causing blindness, loss of limb, I would add pain, or other problems. There is no way to predict how severe the disease will be in any one individual, and no cure or means to prevent its development exists. However, your doctor tells you that research is being conducted, which may lead to a cure or better treatment within 5 to 10 years. He would like your children to be enrolled in a study which would involve their being tested for the disease.
I don't think we have enough for everybody, so we may need some people who could share with us. How many people in the back don't have access to it? Yeah, we get a few sent back there, that would be great.
Drop it,
they have more than you want.
Okay, yeah, it's as long as everybody has access to looking around with them.
Now, in a little bit different way than our first three cases this week, we have listed five questions here that we'd like you to consider in your groups. This is assuming that you already will, at the beginning, consider the principles involved and where the dilemma is. You're very good and practiced at that, and let's not have anybody who's new here today be only in a new group. So let's mix people who've been around and have been using some of these principles. So we do want you to do that. But let's just start with everybody in the large group with this step number one. What other relevant facts or information would you think it was important to know before you discuss this case? Yeah.
Possible cure in 5 to 10 years.
Whether there will be one?
Just the possibility that there is one.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty significant, and it's there. And that is true. Advances are being made, according to our geneticist friend.
I can know a little bit about the purpose of the testing and of the study. The purpose of the study, really, what does the study have as its end goal?
I'm not expert on that. Maybe you, whose name I didn't ask.
Nancy.
Do you know about what specifically some of these studies are studying with
not
people?
Right off.
Yeah. My assumption is, like any study that enrolls participants, they're figuring out treatments of some sort. Maybe trying to figure out how we know ahead of time based on certain symptoms or other kinds of things. Docs, help me out.
Sort of gene penetrance, sort of 50% can carry the gene, and there's such a huge range of expression of this disease, and maybe just getting a data bank going of here's this genetic material, and here's how this kid looks in 20 years.
With the end goal simply, in lay terms, of cure or treatment, to prevent further progression or to...
What is the test? I mean, what does it involve?
Yeah. It's nothing highly invasive. How accurate is the question? This test is about 70% accurate. Commonly, genetic tests are somewhere around 85 to 90% accurate, so one always must ask about the potential for false positives, that it may be one of these children is tested, found to have it, but later realizes that it was false positive, or they may miss.
Another thing to think about is, I know that, well, okay, I had neurofibromatosis, and we had 12 family members with it, and I get a lot of calls from people all over the country with it. And NF, now like I know of a family, the mother has NF, the father does not, and they have a child, 7-year-old child with it. I mean, they have a 7-year-old child that does not have NF. And they could take the test for this kid, but then if you get it on this health record, NF is known as a pre-existing condition. So there goes your health insurance. Yeah.
Which raises the issue of whether a child tested for any genetic disease and found positive accurately and is viewed as diseased or healthy.
And NF is a disorder, not a disease.
Say it again.
NF is a disorder.
Disorder,
not a disease.
Not a disease. Thank you for the correction. Yeah.
Yes, so this raises the issue of who will have access to this data in the short term or the long term.
Yeah, who needs to know it? Correct me if I'm wrong here, the mildest form of NF could be a few moles. The worst could be a brain tumor.
Malignant
brain tumor. Malignant brain tumor.
I have a mild case, but my brother died of a tumor on his brain stem 7 years ago. And I have people in our chapter that are very disfigured by it. So they can span from very mild to very severe.
Other specific questions before you engage each other here?
This ongoing, child being an ongoing research project, are we assuming that this gets tested once a year or gets observed once a year?
Probably some combination thereof. Generally, research studies are not highly invasive or problematic, but it depends on the study and what they're studying and how often a kid would have to be brought to a research center. And I don't know the details about this particular
study. Is it fair to ask if this family has company insurance?
The
company that I work for would have privilege to that information.
Yes, indeed. The human resources person would know, right? Would anybody else know at your company?
There might be some administrative people.
Yeah.
My question is, if you tested Charlie 2 versus 12 or 15, is there any benefit from an earlier versus later in terms of
care? Symptoms tend to show up in the 20s,
early 20s.
I think my question is,
that's what this guy told us yesterday.
Are you better off getting identified at 2 versus 15? So I mean, is this kid going to be,
there's no
the kid is old enough to be kind of like an active participant in the decision, any better than versus making it early?
Well, this is a really excellent question, because if you consider the cases we've had so far this week, we've had infants, and we've had adults, but who are unable to make decisions because of being in a trauma type state. This is very different. We've got children involved who are clearly beyond infant stage, but they're not old enough to be autonomous. So to what degree do you consider children's input in this and age as appropriate issues?
And how soon can symptoms?
Some people with NF type 1, and there's two types, when we're talking about NF type 1, some people with NF type 1 are diagnosed at birth. And they say if they get past the age of 2, they probably won't have it. But then one thing that's not on here, some people with NF will have learning disabilities in school. So you can tell then when they enter school. And also one time is around puberty is when it tends to get a little bit worse.
Okay, a couple more questions.
Yeah, one of the questions is that cost of the long-going, the ongoing evaluations, and how is that handled? Understanding that up front.
In a research study?
Yeah,
no cost to the participants.
understand that, but from a parent standpoint, you want to ask the question because you don't know.
That's right.
Eric, who has a unique chromosome abnormality, is a research patient at the University of Oregon. We go back every year.
Do you have costs with getting there, or do they cover your travel costs getting there?
Travel cost is driving 20, 30 miles, no big deal.
No, for some people without a car,
I understand. Yeah, that would be covered. But the key there is ask up front.
That's right.
Yeah. One more question, then we want to make sure you have time for the test. I mean, Rob has had a hand over too.
Hey, Rob.
Just to clarify here, I think we already have established it, but I don't think it's real clear from how the case is written. If a person has the gene, they will develop the disorder, but you're not sure how seriously.
That's correct.
Yeah.
They have a 50-50 chance of passing on to any kids they might have.
It talks about he does have a gene, but it implies he doesn't have a disorder.
Right.
Yeah, just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
So if the kids have the gene, then they won't have the disorder, even though it may be very limited.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could be anywhere in the
variety.
Okay. 4 to 5 in a group. Try to mix new and longer term people for the week. And dig into the questions, please, and then we'll get together and debrief some other comments.
No.
All right. Which of these principles was helpful in your discussion just now? And why? Don't just list them off, tell us why. You heard the words.
Confidentiality to me was a big one.
Okay.
Because of the concern about people knowing and putting a stigma, especially on at a child age.
Okay. Confidentiality.
At the age of computers, that's a real concern.
Oh, boy, no kidding. And even within the family, might there not be an issue? Who do we tell or not tell within the family, and who gets to know that information, let alone the schools and healthcare and the parents' employers and the neighborhood and the church? Okay.
We had autonomy.
Autonomy?
You know, the right to choose. These children are old enough to hear family discussions and know that they may be at risk, and they have the right to be a part of the decision. So we talked a lot about the children's autonomy.
Okay. At what age does one become autonomous for what kinds of decisions in one's own life? We've made some clear policy choices in our country. You can't decide you're going to drive on freeways till you're a certain age. Can't decide you're ready to vote till a certain age, but this kind of brings that into question. Anything else about that autonomy with minors?
Well, no, not about autonomy.
Okay, hold the thought, because one thing that I heard somebody talking about was these kids no doubt know somebody who has it. It's a familial, inherited genetic disorder. So what if your 7-year-old comes and says, I want to know if I have it, Mom. You know, are you ready to say, well, that's a self-determining statement? Okay, what else
would
you say?
Beneficence.
Okay.
There's no well-being that's going to occur by knowing that you have it. In fact, it could do some harm.
Oh, I disagree.
Perhaps this is our first obvious dilemma. Yes. Somebody articulate the dilemma. First,
there's no
this
cure.
Gentleman.
There's no help. There's no medical help.
Oh.
No cure for it yet.
Okay, you beg to differ.
Yeah.
Why?
This involves a whole spectrum of expressions of this condition as a disease, and tumors can occur anywhere, and they can have any kinds of symptoms, and in many cases, there are specific therapies for specific problems. Although you cannot cure the disease, you can, in many cases,
problems.
You can take care of problems, and if you find them early, these are benign tumors, they're not cancer.
3% of the time they're cancerous, but
yeah, in general, yeah. So there's a lot that can be done if you pay attention to these patients and take care of things.
So you would argue for beneficence because
yes,
we would be attending to whole well-being.
Correct.
Okay. Anybody want to argue back yet, or should we go to the next principle?
Yes, I'm not aware that you could do anything,
yeah.
That you could remove
yeah,
a tumor.
You can have pain control, and as
I would
said,
like to comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
I have multiple sclerosis, and when I was going through all this weird symptoms at first, it was almost a relief for me to find out there was a name for it. You know, because I was feeling weird. Why I'm losing my mind? I'm reimagining this. So it was a relief.
Diagnosis often is a relief.
I would argue that if there's a family history and a strong risk, that any tumor or any other thing would be highly suspicious of having neurofibromatosis rather than waiting it on a laboratory test that might be 70% effective. So I think the beneficence here may be for the greater good of the greater of research, and for maybe 10 years down the road there might be some help for this child's family or the
next
generation.
That's almost going into utility.
Utility.
If we recall, for those of you who are new.
I'm a newcomer. I don't know.
For those of you who are new, beneficence focuses on the person we're talking about. In this case, the 7-year-old or the 9-year-old. But you make the point about utility, greatest good for greatest number. In the long term, might it help a number of people either to test or not to test? Yeah. Okay. Somebody's testing.
He's had a turn.
It's just like our college classes.
The speaker of
You're gonna get to speak up there or something. Like that.
Well, I haven't talked to anybody in 14 years.
Any board members still here? This is the purpose of Holden. Let people talk. Okay.
With regard to promoting well-being and helping an individual patient. If you have an optic glioma, a tumor coming off of the optic nerve, or an acoustic neuroma coming off of the eighth cranial nerve, it could cause blindness. If you take it out, you may get some relief from that, or maybe get your sight back. So there's certainly these tumors, other than just taking them off the skin, taking them off of parts where we know they occur with regularity in different peoples, are healing.
Healing. Are you arguing for testing then?
Oh, you betcha.
That would be beneficial.
And then I'll just take the opposite tack, that I'm assuming that this 7 and 9-year-old are healthy and have no symptoms. And I will watch them like a hawk, like any parent would, for any condition. I could get an acoustic neuroma tomorrow. I don't have neurofibromatosis. So we wait and watch. That's my...
I want to just ask a question along this line. If we're invoking beneficence here, can you also see whether non-maleficence would be relevant here?
Sure.
How so? How might it be relevant here?
How would testing be harmful or not testing be harmful?
The consequences of insurance, all those kinds of issues, people knowing, prejudicial kinds of things can be of harm to this kid too.
Okay.
I can think of examples where people are identified of having a disease when they in fact don't have it. If I've got a test that's only 70% positive, I could misidentify 30% of these kids who's got a family history. Now they've seen other people in the family die at a young age from a tumor. I identify a child as having this, and I say, "You've got this," and and he says, "Geez, I'm going to die at a young age." And so I'm going to live my life differently, only to find out later that he was in a 30% that really was a false positive or something like that. So I'm not sure. I think there's a non-maleficence.
Some have argued that the psychological burden of have children carrying information that they can't fully comprehend, but they can raise lots of fears, outweighs the potential benefit. But of course that raises the question, do you test them and not tell them? Do you test them at age 7 and say, "I'll tell you at age 15?
And
or you test them and not let them know they've been tested.
Test them at age 15.
Then do you carry a family secret with which all the literature says kids picked up? They know something.
Yeah, they know something's going on.
So you can't wait 8 years to tell them. We purposely said 7 and 9. You know, 2 and 4 might have been a little clearer for some of you. 15, 17 might have been very clear for most of you. 7 and 9, you know, you had something to say.
I think that it's when I was 7, which wasn't that long ago, and 9.
How nice for you.
Yeah. Are you bragging?
Bragging to make you young.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I see you.
But see, I mean, I think I was conscious enough to comprehend some of these things, maybe not everything, and maybe, like my father was saying, it's like sex, when kids ask about sex. And then you tell them everything there is to know about sex. They're like, "Ew, you know, I didn't want to know that." So, but But I mean, there's something that you have to impart to your kids if you have this knowledge, or else there is kind of an honesty that's, I mean, this trust that's broken for the kid.
I was hoping somebody would talk about this. What about the parental duties, calls under duties, to be honest, to not deceive?
Again,
when is that, when do we start that? At birth? Or
and yet parents always withhold some information that they don't think their children are able to handle for the benefit of the children. Mm-hmm. Moving in was, Louise said, maternalism or paternalism.
But they don't have, well, yeah, it's like withholding information, but it's not necessarily, but it's not lying, or it's not, I don't know, it's withholding information. It's not
giving fidelity,
but
yeah, not being dishonest per se.
And I teach 7 and 9 year olds, and I would argue very strongly that I have enough maleficence that if they have not shown symptoms, you cannot tell, because the benefit burden continuum would be way for me warping the burden.
Should you test them, or neither test nor tell?
Well, I'm more focusing on the telling aspect. The testing to me is a little bit more, but you know, that it's more of the I mean, not hearing the medical issues. I mean, physicians are going back and forth on that. But as somebody who I think understands 7 and 9 year olds, I don't. If there's no symptoms, I don't think you tell them. Even if they are positive.
And what about you, who's worked with a lot of learning disabled kids?
That's a different issue.
If that came up, right, would you maybe change that because of this thing? If I know what I have, then I know why I have this, and I will perhaps, not everybody, accept the special help, the special ed kids who get special treatment.
So once symptoms or issues start showing up,
right,
then you might.
Symptoms show up, then.
And I'll take the other end. I teach junior high. Junior high kids are big on fairness and honesty. And you tell a 14-year-old that they have this, and they ask you, how long have you known? You said, known since you were 7 or 9. They are going to be mad. They're going to say, why have you kept this from me all this time? And I think for that time until they develop, yeah, there's a bliss. But man, the minute you bring that up, you know, are you willing to take on the fact that you may have just damaged your relationship with your child?
You totally at a time when at junior high, anyway.
Is there an issue here where these kids know that uncle had apparently had a sufficient disorder that it was known to the degree that the parent had himself or herself tested, and the children probably don't know the results of that, but they do know that
we don't know how much was that
had
uncle, the brother,
the disorder. And is there not discussion within the family about that, and would that not raise fears for the children that might get back to knowing the name of whatever it is if there are...
50% of the time it comes from a parent. With another 50% of the time, it comes from a spontaneous mutation in the gene. So I get calls from people who just say, my kid has NF and we have no family history of it. So in that case, there's no family member with it.
But then there's also a 50% chance that if there is a family member, it will be passed on. And
that
the parent has it.
That child who has NF and there's no family history, they have a 50-50 chance of passing along to their kids.
His mother is a family history.
I think for me, I would look at it as telling the child, because there seems to be a fear element that we don't want to tell the child for some reason. And I think of children that have been sexually abused too, but once they realize they're like one out of two sexually abused, and when they can talk about it and find that other children have it, there's a little bit more comfort. So withholding information for a child seems to be more fear-based, that we can't openly discuss this. And it also brings in the family unit as we go through this together, we're going to learn about this, that sort of thing. So I'm kind of like with him. I think withholding information would be very detrimental to the family.
But if you're asymptomatic, mm-hmm, not showing any symptoms, and you come with a child and say, I want to tell you something, you've got something that could lead to brain tumors, but it might not.
But what are you going to bring the child to the doctor?
Genetic condition.
Yeah, I mean, you've told them.
I have it too. My 9-year-old, 8-year-old would get on the internet and type it right in. And she would find out a lot.
Okay.
Call Nancy's 1-800.
Then you have the opportunity for dialogue then with the kid to discuss those things.
If the kid will ask. Yeah, kid will ask. Okay, somebody has a question.
But there's also at least two
family members with the same with the same set. How do you tell the kid? You're like me.
Another alternative. Tell the child you're like me.
You're like me.
I'm the carrier. You got it.
I'm also trying to.
Yeah, let me just throw out another idea here. I really didn't speak yet. Except to say yes to you. Let me throw out another idea about promoting well-being, and it may get into the fact that we may need some more medical information. But it's my understanding that if you know a kid is positive for this, that you can screen them in certain ways. I also know a kid that has neuroprogrammatic
screen them for
different problems that may come up, nerve tumors, whatever. I also know a kid that has a seizure disorder from this. If you kept this from the kid, and it was possible to screen him just to see that, you know, to see if things were looking okay, and you didn't, and that kid first had his evidence of this by having a seizure when he was driving a car, then what would you, or swimming, then what would you think about promoting well-being? If it's not possible to screen for that, then I retract that. But
are people clear about what the screening is? You're tested, you're positive, and then you can have various kinds of tests to look for various potential symptoms or, what's the word I'm looking for?
Manifestations.
Manifestations,
yes.
Thank you. Of the disorder that can be treated. You know, manage that medication. Yeah.
My question though, there is, can't you do all those tests without ever having known? If you know there's a chance they might have it, can't you just in a yearly physical, like with kids, just kind of be monitoring anyways?
Screen me for seizures, but I'm not sure if I have this.
Well, I'm saying just, you know, just if you make it aware to your family physician that these kind of things might start showing up, can't you just do a certain amount of.
See, traditionally what you would do as a physician, if you would do a genetic history, you might go ahead and do a CAT scan, you might go ahead and do some other things, but you may not have the definitive diagnosis.
And then the kid said, why are you doing all this on my sports physical? And then you have to decide.
No, we're talking about symptomatic stuff now, yeah. Right?
Well, are you saying screening is asymptomatic?
Well, I guess I'm just saying just constant kind of observation, like she said before. You're going to watch your kid like a hawk. So when you go in and you talk to your physician before, like just basic physicals, not a sports physical, because that's like test your reflexes and cough. So
okay, let's do this. Did any group come to consensus? Yes, test both children. You did. Okay. Let me ask the last question that we got to close. What about these kids enrolling them in a research study?
Depends on the severity.
Say more. Just depends on the severity of their NF.
Yeah.
Because if they had a lot of troubles with it.
Well, if they're asymptomatic.
Or what body part is it?
Okay. Because that might be a burden benefit from their point of view. If they're already going to the doctor a lot for symptom control or other kinds of treatments, then also the research study is too much burden. Is that part of what you're saying? Okay.
Well, the question here is how do you balance the potential utility, the good that can come for society, with the duty to promote the child's well-being as the primary concern?
You've got to kind of make that decision. How much time is it going to take? How much of a anxiety is going to produce in the child to go through these extra tests?
And would you say that it does require the child's consent?
I would at this age.
Mm-hmm. 7 or 9.
They're old enough to say.
Yeah.
Tell me.
And utility isn't just for society. It may be for these children's children.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. If I'm going to send them to the test, I'm sure going to have hold of them. Yeah.
The question we asked was, if we enroll the child in a study, will they benefit from any experimental treatments?
Yeah.
Or cures that come? That's a real important thing to consider.
Especially if something all of a sudden seems to be working well. My understanding is sometimes studies are stopped right there and give them a treatment right then for them. Okay, we better close. The end of time. Come back tomorrow on human cloning.
I just have one.
Nancy has one more.